I'll say a few words without interruption. Try to keep the number of words down as much as I can, and then open the floor to discussion to find out what you really want to know about the Declaration of Independence. It may seem strange that there should be such curiosity about a document that is more than 200 years old. I once gave a lecture in England at, I think, Norwich University, and a young British historian came up to me afterwards and he said, "But that's an 18th century document. You treated it as if it was a 20th century document. It's still 20th century then." And I said, "Well, the one thing that never occurred to Jefferson in drafting the Declaration was that he was drafting an 18th century document." Lincoln, in his the eulogy of Jefferson, in the letter to Pierce, the one that he wrote in 1859 when there was a celebration of Jefferson's birthday, and he was in Boston, and he was invited, and he had to decline the invitation, but he wrote a letter, which is really one of the most important documents of his career, which is filled with important documents of Lincoln's composition. But he said, "All honor to Jefferson, to the man who, in the concrete pressure of a merely revolutionary war, introduced an abstract truth applicable to all men in all times." Well, I think that I may be the only person who has written on the Declaration who believes there are abstract truths applicable to all men in all times. The alienation of the academic profession from the principles of the American Revolution. And by the way, I think of the American Revolution, I think of it not as an event. It's an event in time, but it's also an event that is outside of time. Principles that refer to all men at all times, as Lincoln said about that abstract truth. And the abstract truth, of course, was the proposition that all men are created equal, a proposition which has confused many people and enlightened a few. I think I'm one of the few, and I hope everybody in this room will be part of that few, that magic number. What does it mean to say that all men are created equal? Well, it's very clear from the text from Locke, John Locke's text in the Second Treatise, that it's an equality of what Locke calls dominion. No human being is by nature the ruler of another human being. The way in which any human being is by nature the ruler of any dog or any horse. It doesn't matter whether you've trained the dog or horse, you know that when you see it. A human being and a dog or a horse, that one is by nature destined to rule the other if there's any connection at all. And that's really an empirical proposition. All you have to do is see one human being next to another human being, and if one human being claims to be the descendant of God or have spoken with God and therefore is intended to rule the other, you know that that's a fraud. One of my favorite quotations from Maimonides is that if somebody comes up to you and says, "The Lord God of the universe, blessed be his name, has told me thus and so," do not believe him. That means that legitimate government arises from consent. It doesn't arise, it's by nature that people have to consent, but there's no natural rule of one human being by another. Only when human beings have consented together voluntarily to form a political community does the legitimate authority arise. And the initial form of that authority is a decision by the majority. But the original consent by which human beings form themselves into political communities is unanimous. There's unanimity. Anybody who doesn't want to join doesn't have to join. It's a voluntary matter. But anybody who does join does so on the basis of his recognition that every other one who joins with him has the same rights that he has from the political community. He also has the same obligations. The formation of a political community is at the same time the formation of a militia. Our Second Amendment speaks about the importance of militias and of ownership of weapons, because the most elementary, not the highest, but certainly the most elementary and the most fundamental purpose in forming a political community is that each person will have the protection of the whole community for his person and his property. While by nature people are independent, they also are by nature the protectors of their own persons and property, and no man can protect his own person and property in a world of predators, which is the world of nature, unless he has a community behind him. If you can imagine the formation of communities on the American frontier in the 18th century, scattered families meet together and form a community to protect them. They build a stockade so that if they're under assault by the French or the Indians, they can go inside the stockade and be defended. And if somebody says, well, I want to be inside the stockade and I want to be defended, but I don't want to be on the firing line because that's too dangerous, they say, you're out, unless you're willing to take your chances. So the militia really involves every able-bodied man or woman, for that matter. So, since when the community is under siege, everyone may have to play their part. So the responsibility for defending oneself through the community is equal, and the same equality applies to the taxation which is necessary to support the community in its defensive mode. So that equality of right and of responsibility is the basic element of equality which pervades the entire community on the basis of that unanimous consent to join the community and to accept both the protection of the community and the responsibility for forming part of that protective force. So that's what the elemental principle of equality means. And I think it's very plain and very simple, very easy to understand, and that's why no historian that I know of has ever understood it. Most important book ever written on the Declaration of Independence was Carl Becker's book, which has that title, the Declaration of Independence, published in 1922 originally. And it's a beautifully written book. And Carl Becker, who was president of the American Historical Association and was one of the most, if not the most distinguished scholar of his age. And it's beautiful. The book is beautiful to read as a theory of the British Empire in the 18th century and all sorts of features, and he said in the last chapter, to ask whether the philosophy of natural rights of the Declaration of Independence is true or false is essentially a meaningless question. A meaningless question. Well, if that's a meaningless question, then it's meaningless to ask whether the American Revolution was justified or not. It would also be meaningless to ask whether the Union or the Confederate side was the right side. There was a book just published this year, I think it is, by a Yale professor, my alma mater. I forget the subtitle is A Moral History of the Civil War. And in that book, the Professor Stout, his name is, announced that the question of who was right or who was wrong, those questions are too complicated, and we don't have the equipment to decide such questions. I'm in exchange with him in the Claremont Review of Books for the next issue, I think. And I said that what Leo Strauss called the crisis of the West is visible, is nowhere more visible than an Ivy League professor saying he can't decide which side was the right side in the Civil War. Much better if he decided in favor of the Confederates than to say that you have no way of knowing, you see. this man thinks there's never no way of knowing who's right and who's wrong. And that's the confusion at the highest level. I say the degree of sophistication in moral matters is in inverse proportion to the years of higher education a person has. People who only finished the eighth grade have no confusion on these matters at all. They know. But when you get up to Ivy League professors, they're just totally confused by some moral questions. Well, that's the elementary basis, I think. And now I'd be glad to find out what concerns you people. So raise your hand if you want to ask a question or if you want to tell me why I'm wrong, either way. What kind of teachers are you when you don't have...
If nobody else... But how do you feel about the concept of not only the Declaration of Independence following us through history, but the Constitution?
Pick up a little louder.
But not only the Declaration of Independence follows us through history, but also that the Constitution follows us through history.
Okay, very good. Well, Lincoln once wrote a meditation on a verse in the Book of Proverbs. A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold and pictures of silver. That's, of course, the King James translation. Pictures means a framework for the picture. And he said that the apple of gold is the proposition of equality. That is the Constitution is the frame around it. The frame is for the sake of the apple, not the apple for the frame. The essential purpose of the Constitution is to be found, cannot be found in the Constitution itself. Now one of the great debates raging in constitutional law right now, but it's raging with me and the others, is the question of original intent. And I published a book called Original Intent and the Framers of the Constitution. The so-called conservatives are all in favor of original intent. And the liberals, beginning with Justice Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan, are leading the way there in favor of what they call a living constitution. Well, Thurgood Marshall, in 1987, refused to celebrate the 200th anniversary of the Constitution because he said the Constitution was a racist document since it protected slavery. He and those who thought as he did believed that the Constitution, by both protecting slavery and recognizing capital punishment, and Justice Brennan was famous for saying that we have evolved to a higher level of moral consciousness than the people who wrote the Constitution. We know that capital punishment is immoral. And so we have to say that the capital punishment is outlawed by, I think, the Eighth Amendment, which forbids cruel and unusual punishments. The solid basis for their critique is the fact the Constitution does protect slavery. There are three main provisions of the Constitution. The three-fifths clause in Article 1, counting federal numbers, the provision of legitimizing the foreign slave trade for another 20 years, and then, most important of all, the fugitive slave clause of Article 4, which says that the persons held to service or labor in one state escaping into another shall not be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be returned to those to whom the service or labor is due. It doesn't say slaves, it says persons, and that creates a problem. But there's no question that shall be delivered means that the federal government has a responsibility to recapture or capture runaway slaves and return them to their masters. That since that provision seems to, in fact, does contradict the idea of all men are created equal, so they say, well, the Constitution and the Declaration have no real connection with each other. When they wrote the Constitution, they paid no attention to the Declaration. Well, of course, the contrary is the case, since the people who drafted the Constitution knew that it would be difficult to get it ratified, and the ratification process was a very hard-fought battle, and it narrowly succeeded in both Virginia and New York, where Madison and Hamilton both published the Federalist Papers. So what justification is there? Well, without some concessions to slavery, the Constitution had no chance of being ratified. And if it had not been ratified, the position of slavery would have been far stronger, as it was under the Articles of Confederation. There's no power in the federal government to do anything about slavery. And the 20-year provision extending the life of the foreign slave trade, which really was a terrible thing, because the foreign slave trade was a terrible thing. By the way, on that subject, when Muhammad Ali had his fight in Zaire with George Foreman, when he was leaving, they asked him what he thought about Africa. He said, "Boy, am I glad my grandpappy got on that boat." So it was a terrible thing, but the consequence was that some people of African descent became Americans, in their own mind at least, and that's another long story. But although the African slave trade was extended for 20 years, the provision was made for ending it in 20 years, which wouldn't have been possible under probably any other constitution. The question of what the status of what the relation of the Declaration was, and the interpretation of the Constitution itself in the debates that raged in the 1850s after the Mexican War, with the Spastic acquisition of territory, which had to be formed into territories and then into states, whether slavery was to be extended or not. The one school thought that since the Fifth Amendment, since the adoption of the Fifth Amendment, said that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, the question is a black man in a territory a person or a chattel? The anti-slavery cause that a black man is a person. He's called a person throughout the Constitution, just as women are called. There's no distinction of sex either in the language of the Constitution. Therefore, if a black man is taken into a territory by a slave owner, he becomes free by reason of the fact that in the absence of positive law, as there is in the states, a person is entitled to his freedom by the Fifth Amendment. The other side said, no person shall be deprived of property, And if somebody brings a slave into a territory, that is his property, and he can't be deprived of that. But which of the language of the Constitution is by itself open to either interpretation? There's no logic that can say, well, on the basis of the Constitution itself, which interpretation shall prevail. It's only by the application of the principles of the Declaration that you can say his human personality prevails over his legal chatteldom. By the way, in Southern law, for example, slaves were also referred to both as chattels and as persons. Slaves were held responsible for either violence or threat, except that they were not treated like dogs or horses. You can't put a dog or a horse in prison for doing something bad. He's just subject to the discipline of his master. But they were held responsible, and they were regarded as persons. But in every other respect, they were regarded as chattels. Now, the definition of a chattel is a piece of movable property without a will of its own, So a person cannot be a chattel and a chattel cannot be a person. And yet, under the law of slavery, Negro slaves were regarded as both persons and chattels. And which definition would ultimately prevail depended upon events. So the Constitution was never really intelligible, apart from some principle of interpretation external to the Constitution itself. Now, the Constitution, I think in Article, I forget which article, says that, I think Article 5 says that the United States shall guarantee to every state of the Union a republican form of government. But there's nothing in the Constitution that tells you what a republican form of government is. You can draw inferences from the structure of the government itself, but that leaves open to interpretation a whole mess of problems, you see. Now, in the debate going on today, conservatives, jurists, by and large, with the exception of Clarence Thomas, the only judge on the Supreme Court who recognizes the Declaration as having any constitutional status whatever, they want to have an original intent, original intent by itself has no authority for anybody who looks at the slavery clauses of the Constitution. Without discriminating between the compromises of the Constitution and the principles of the Constitution, the original intent of the Constitution, is valueless or worthless. Yet this is the position that was upheld by Justice Rehnquist and Justice Scalia and Judge Bork and the whole Federal Society. They owe original intent but no Declaration of Independence. Well, it just doesn't make any sense that way. They don't make any sense. They don't think I make any sense. So we're squared off. And I just hope everybody in this room knows which side he's on. Hello.
Well, I do know which side I'm on in that argument.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to how you, and I think I know, you just told me, when you take these words, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, mm-hmm. that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, mm-hmm. that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. How do you equate that to prisoners being held in Guantanamo in this war on terror?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the United States of America is a sovereign nation and has all the attributes of sovereignty. Without going into details, which I probably am not competent to do anyway, there's so many intricacies in positive law, that defending ourselves from terrorists is certainly a function of the federal government. And anything that is necessary, that is really necessary to do that, I think it's constitutional. I think the president has an untapped reservoir of war powers. Lincoln certainly thought that. If he didn't, then the Emancipation Proclamation would have been a nullity. And Lincoln knew, by the way, that when the hostilities came to an end, that the legal effect of the emancipation would come to an end. That's why he strove mightily to have the 13th Amendment passed, which would make the abolition of slavery a legal necessity. So that's whether the difference between military detention and the detention of accused criminals under civil law, those are niceties which I wouldn't want to go into, but I've no doubt in my mind that under the war powers of the president, and given the unique circumstances of the attack on 9/11, which we were attacked by whom? By terrorists. We can't enter into negotiations with an enemy over the treatment of prisoners of war, for example. At the beginning of the Civil War, there was a great deal of difficulty over whether or not captured soldiers on either side could be legally detained in order. And so, at first, Lincoln was reluctant to do anything that would recognize or seemed to recognize the Confederacy, but he was forced to because circumstances were such that Union soldiers could have no protection unless Confederate soldiers did. So, things will work out that way. But you know that recently there have been stories released about one of the prisoners claiming now that he was responsible for the attacks of 9/11. Whether he was telling the truth or not is another matter. But certainly the interrogation of prisoners to try to find out who was attacking us and what we could do to retaliate, those are functions as a sovereign nation. We have the duty to protect our citizens. That's part of the original contract.
Yeah. I wondered if you would talk a little bit about what you think the meaning of the word is, consent. When you say legitimate government arises by consent,
mm-hmm.
both in today's world, when, for example, in the Iraq War, we actually have forces in there, or back in Lincoln's time when the South succeeded, are you referring to consent being an election?
The basic theory of the Declaration, which starting from the proposition that all men are created equal, which means that all are equal in authority. It doesn't mean they're equal in virtue, intelligence, or anything. They're equally human. There is a human nature which is the basis of human rights. And that is by the way, it's important to see that was a revolutionary idea in human history. All governments that we know of before then were usually the results of families, as Aristotle explains in the Politics, families forming clans and clans forming tribes, and then tribes forming cities, here, political communities. It was a growth of aggregation. And at each stage of the aggregation, the government of the first of the family, we know that from the story in the Bible, which is in a way not merely is not unique, but it's prototypical. The older families either had gods or spoke to gods who were responsible for their laws, and the laws came down from the gods. And when a city was formed, it would be the Senate, which meant the older families who had dwelt there longest and whose gods were the most authoritative, became the gods of the city. Athens was the god of Athens was Athena. And the Acropolis, inside the Acropolis, when it was built, was a huge statue of Athena. The statue of Lincoln in the Lincoln Memorial comes very close to what an ancient city was like. And Lincoln is there as a kind of god, you see, which would have amused him greatly, I'm sure. He would have had a whole series of stories to tell about that. He had stories to tell about everything. But the idea that we are not primarily members of families and tribes, but that we are first and all human beings, that was substituting, you might say, nature for the gods of the ancient city. And even in modern times, post-classical times, the British, the monarchy and aristocracy, they're having big debates in England right now what to do with the House of Lords, because it's clearly an anachronism. I think it's a sort of a fun anachronism, seeing them on television in their fancy robes and stuff like that, gathered to hear the speech from the throne, the speech which we all know was written by the Prime Minister. but still, the primogeniture is the basis of the monarchy, see. And one of the first things that happened in Virginia, at least in the American Revolution, one of the first things that Jefferson, who was rabid to do, is to abolish primogeniture and entail. Entail was the system by which estates were maintained in their integrity and they couldn't be broken up and sold. When somebody inherited an entailed estate, he didn't really own it, you see. Under feudal law, there was no such thing as ownership in our sense of the term, of complete control over your property. So the primogeniture and entail reflected the idea of authority being inherited, you see, and within historic time. But the Declaration of Independence says no. We're the oldest title to authority is not anything historical, but is nature. And Lincoln at one point said, "Repeal the Declaration of Independence. Repeal all previous history. You cannot repeal nature." And by nature, people are equal in authority, and any government to which they are subject is one which reflects their consent, you see. So the consent of the governed is first and foremost the idea, you might say, which is it does not depend upon historical circumstances as to when the consent was given. If, as a matter of fact, in the new world, the states all had their governments, all they may have had royal charters. The real effective basis of the government was the colonists coming together and agreeing that to form a political community. These political communities resulted in the 13 states, which eventually formed a union. George Washington, in the letter by which he transmitted the Constitution to the Congress to be submitted to the people for ratification, said that that these states had to give up some of their rights in order to protect the others, just as we did when we consented to the basic act of consent that made us political communities in the first place. So Washington clearly assumed the truth of the logic of the argument that I've given you today, that there's a unanimous consent. Out of that unanimous consent arises majority rule. But it's important to understand that majority rule is limited by the purposes embodied in the original consent. The majority can do anything that could have been consented to unanimously. Because majority rule is the practical substitute for unanimity. But without the unanimity, there can be no real authorization for the majority. That's very important because, for example, Justice Scalia, I have a book, Storm Over the Constitution, with a chapter on Scalia. And Scalia says that the whole theory of democracy is majority rule. And when asked, what about the minority? He said, they lose. There are no minority rights except what the majority gives them. See? That's crazy. And because the majority is limited to those things that could have been agreed to, that were in effect agreed to unanimously. It's only within the framework of unanimity that majority rule takes place. And the individuals who consent, further, this is of course very important, that the people who are consenting to that original unanimity are people who we hold to be endowed by their creator with certain rights, you see. That's why we don't really need a Bill of Rights. We didn't need a Bill of Rights, and Madison didn't think we needed a Bill of Rights when he wrote participated in the Federalists. Either he knew Hamilton wanted to have a Bill of Rights because they said if you try to enumerate rights, you will imply that there are no other rights except those which are enumerated. And both the Declaration and the Bill of Rights are open. The Declaration says that men are endowed with certain inalienable rights, among which and by the way, if you follow the line of the Declaration, it's interesting how the original declaration, original reference to rights, is replaced when, if any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, the rights become ends. People are authorized to form a new government, which to them will satisfy them. I'm not getting the exact words. Secure their safety and happiness. That's A to Z. And safety and happiness are the ends of the city, according to Aristotle. So Locke is transformed into Aristotle, right in the crucial sentence of the Declaration of Independence. Yes?
But if we as a nation abandon the the concept of having had a creator,
mm-hmm.
by what authority have we got the inalienable rights anymore?
None.
Exactly. Well, then where are we?
Well, we I haven't abandoned the creator, have you?
No. But I look around me and I find that our government.
Yes, of course. Well, if a justice of the Supreme Court says that the minority lose if the majority doesn't grant them rights, where are we? What use is our Supreme Court?
Yes.
We're here to resolve that these rights shall not have been lost, and the people who deny the role of the Creator in the establishment of our frame of government are not really entitled to be citizens of a free society. There's no question but that the theology of the Declaration of Independence is a philosophical and a theological document. It envisages the divine government of the universe, and it's only within that framework. And the secularists who want to say that any mention of God is unconstitutional are saying that the Declaration of Independence is unconstitutional. In point of fact, the Constitution isn't a Constitution without the Declaration of Independence. Yes?
There's in Washington's farewell address, which was not an address, there's a critical section in there that says, in vain would the person claim to be a patriot,
yeah.
who would try to eliminate the
right.
two props of religion and morality. And he goes on to say that national morality cannot be maintained
mm-hmm.
without religion.
Yeah,
I'll which goes back to the Northwest Ordinance as well.
But whatever may be conceded to the influence of a refined education on minds of a peculiar structure, reason and experience forbid us to expect that national morality can prevail in exclusion of religious principles. That's the whole quote. That's pretty good. In other words, there are always some people around here who are so smart that they don't have to believe in God, but put them to one side. The rest of us, poor folks, we need God. Yes.
Dr. Chubb, I'd like to bring this back around to kind of where we started, which is the Second Amendment, because
mm-hmm.
right early on you touched a button with me. Because lately, you know, what's been happening in the federal courts with Washington, D.C. looks like it's going to push this whole issue of the Second Amendment back into the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I probably don't have enough higher education because to me this whole issue seems rather simple.
In other words, you're too intelligent to...
And we look back, I mean, looking, because I've often thought, just as you said, that the political community requires to maintain liberty and rights requires responsibility, which requires a militia. The Second Amendment has a long tradition going far back in history and seems to me to indicate that we have an unalienable right as citizens to bear arms, not so that we can go hunting, but to preserve and defend the liberty of ourselves, our families, and our extended political community.
Yes, well,
Am I going wrong? Am I seeing this too simply? Or is it just that there are forces at work that just seem to be determined to ignore Locke and the Constitution and the Declarations?
Well, in the first place, you're absolutely right. The position that you maintain follows necessarily from the proposition that all men are created equal. Because of that, human beings have a right to associate with other human beings on the basis of equality. Nobody can claim, because I'm so intelligent, therefore my life is worth more than your life, and since you can defend me, but I won't defend you, that doesn't work. So the initial, the unanimous consent, which is the basis, the whole basis for the whole idea of equal justice under law, which is on the Supreme Court building, all that, that it follows from that unanimous consent that the original form of the political community itself is a militia. And I think that's what the Second Amendment. Now, if you say that the Supreme Court, that the Declaration of Independence has no constitutional standing, which is what most justices of the Supreme Court would say today, then there's no basis for the militia. And the people who argue against the militia are really arguing against the whole structure of ideas stemming from or embodied in the Declaration of Independence.
So it seems to me that it's a fallacy to argue that the militia means the National Guard or some organized formal body of people. It also seems to me a fallacy to say that arms, the keeping and bearing arms, is only inherent to those officially designated bodies. But rather, to me, it seems that that common notwithstanding, that this right to keep and bear arms is a right of every able-bodied citizen and has nothing to do, really, with an organized...
it's the right of every able-bodied citizen to accept the responsibility of a citizen arising from that unanimous consent and arising in turn from the proposition of human equality. It forms a series of propositions which are logically interdependent, you see. But the point is that the original citizen body resulting from the unanimous consent is itself a militia, and the right to bear arms, I think, follows from that. Yes.
But it also says a well-regulated militia. It doesn't say a bunch of vigilantes running around out here shooting at each other, like as it happens in Lebanon with their four rival militias.
Well, they're all tribal. Armies arising from the existence of tribes that never formed into a civil society. Yes.
See, I'd like to take this on a little bit. I don't think that the Second Amendment gives you the right to own any type of weapon you would like to have. We don't have the right to own a nuclear weapon to defend our homestead against those who might encroach upon it. And I think that if you go to the Virginia Declaration of Rights, Article 13, I think is critical to understanding what Madison had intended in the Second Amendment and why the Senate excised language from it. I do not know, but there it was very clear that it was that permanent standing armies were dangerous to liberty. That's the key thing it said. And that the body of the people trained to arms was the safest security against a permanent standing army. So I do think that it means that you have the right, certainly, to own some type of weapon to defend yourself. I don't think it gives you the right to Saturday night specials. I don't think it gives you the right to an operational M1A Abrams tank. I don't think it gives you the right to a bazooka. I think the clear idea, but it does give you the right to something, without a doubt. But it was clearly to be a part of a militia to defend yourself against permanent standing armies, which they did find as dangerous to liberty.
Well, the opposition to permanent standing armies is also opposition to the royal control. The Declaration of Independence, almost all of the principles, I think everything except federalism, is in the Declaration of Independence. Civilian control, that's absolutely essential. So the militia has got to be regulated by civilian control, some form of government which results in other than that, I agree with you. Yeah.
Technically, we don't have permanent standing armies, right? That's what have to be appropriated for them every two years, right?
Well, there's no source of taxation other than through the representatives of the people. Yes.
You were saying Clarence Thomas is the only one that believes that on the present Supreme Court, the other eight do not believe the same way he does with regards to the verity of the Constitution, I mean the Declaration being having standing with the Constitution. Whether Supreme Court justices, say in recent generations, believe the same way he does?
Well, they don't even discuss it anymore. There's nothing more disgraceful in our recent history than the hearings on Supreme Court nominees. The senators, all the Democrats want to know is, are you going to vote the reverse Roe v. Wade? And all of the conservatives want to know is, will you vote? and the nominees know that if they answer either way, they're dead. So any discussion of the kind that we're having here today in high circles of the Federal Society, which is largely under the domination of Robert Bork, and who want to know what book I might think of each other, the back pages of the National Review. I when his book, Tempting of America, which I think is the worst book on constitutional law ever written, and it appeared with endorsements on the back from Ronald Reagan, Irving Kristol, George Will, I forget the fourth person, none of whom obviously had ever read a word of it. Irving Kristol called it the greatest book on constitutional ever written, and I say it's the worst book, so there's some difference of opinion there. But the basis of my criticism, I wrote an article which was published in National Review, and in which I cited the fact that that Bork had said that the instrument by which the living constitution people had taken seized the whole subject of constitutionality away from the Constitution was substantive due process. And the first example, he said, of substantive due process, which set the pattern for the whole future, was Taney's opinion in Dred Scott, in which he said Taney had invented a right to own slaves which was nowhere in the Constitution. And how could it? In 200 years, nobody had ever doubted that slavery was recognized in the Constitution. And Bork obviously thought the way to get it, not to have to use the Declaration, is to say that there was no slavery in the Constitution. But this is simply a lie. And I nailed him on this, and he, then the National Review gave him my book on original intent to review, in which he savaged it. And then we had a debate which was in which they gave him the last word, and the last word in his in the debate between us was he finally acknowledged, yes, the Constitution did recognize slavery, but only in a few places. This is the level at which public discussion has taken up. And I didn't. I published a Storm of the Constitution with a sequel to Original Intent, in which I went over the debates, in which I gave myself the last word. Yes.
But I'm just wondering, you know, like justice, like Charles Evans Hughes or Taft or Holmes or any, did they ever, any of them,
Holmes said that these were all epigones of the progressive movement, and the progressive movement was regarded itself as progressive because it progressed beyond the Declaration of Independence. On that subject, one of my heroes has written, I think one of the great commentators on the Declaration, who was clearly not a college professor, was the President of the United States on the 150th anniversary. In fact, that's when I got really interested in this subject, because I remember in 1976 I got through the mail a publication, beautifully bound letters of the bicentennial messages of President Gerald R. Ford. And I read through them, and one thing was perfectly clear, that none of them had been written by President Gerald R. Ford. I could easily recognize the ones written by my friend Robert Goldwyn, since I knew his style. But then it occurred to me, well, who was president then? It was Calvin Coolidge. What did the President of the United States say on the 150th anniversary? Well, as it turned out, his speech was on July 5th, not on July 4th, 1926. July 4th happened to be on a Sunday, but it also was his birthday. And he's the only president of the United States born on the 4th of July. And nobody deserved to be born on the 4th of July more than Calvin Coolidge. He never referred to it, and he never forgot it either. And he had on the inspiration of the Declaration, it's a wonderful speech, and in which he said that when the Declaration says that all men are created equal, this is final. When it says that the just powers of government are derived from the consent of the governed, this is final. Anyone who tries to go beyond these truths, he will not go forward, he will go backward, he will be a reactionary. That's a denial of the progressive movement, you see. It's interesting, that was 1926. Carl Becker's book on the Declaration was originally published in 1922. Almost every educated person during that era in the day knew what Carl Becker said. The speech given by the President of the United States on the 150th anniversary got almost no notice and is not recorded in any history book that I know.
I think the textbook we use at our school, part of that is up in there.
Is what?
Part of his speech on that is in the textbook.
You mean in the Coolidge's speech?
Yes.
Well, good for whoever included it.
Abeka.
Abeka's. Yeah, but not Coolidge's.
No, I mean the Coolidge's speech is in one of the
Abeka
books.
Oh, it is. Good. Well, it should be read by, and Coolidge said what Lincoln had said before him, that most, if not all, of our prosperity depended upon the Declaration of Independence. The idea of equal opportunity. Lincoln's speech in Philadelphia on his way to his inauguration. It was this that they had hoped that the burden of inequality, the image he used was really derived from Pilgrim's Progress, the burden of sin that people carried on their path. And this, the Declaration was going to do for the inequalities in this world, presumably the Savior did for the inequalities arising from original sin.
Is that what he meant by the almost chosen people?
That's what.
Isn't that the same speech?
You're talking about Lincoln.
Lincoln called us the almost chosen people.
Well, I think that was designed to exempt him from any charge of infidelity. Or he wasn't trying to argue with the Bible. He was in fact using the Bible's authority as much as he could. But I would be perfectly willing to repeat that without the almost. Because there is no example in human history of a government being based upon the natural equality of human beings, and that natural equality in the sense in which it was meant, I think is something that is easy to verify. If you line up a line of human beings and take all their clothes off and look at them, you can't tell which one is a lord and which one is a serf and which one is a king and which one is a subject. The natural difference that occurs between the human species and the other species is, I think, the one which is in fact described in the book of Genesis, which is which reflects not the process of evolution but the end of evolution, which is the world that we live in. Yes.
The readings include some pretty interesting questions. I was wondering if you could address the first question was, do the laws of nature and of nature's God impose any obligations that we are not free to disregard?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sure. Well, I think the fact that the Declaration says we are endowed with certain unalienable rights, will take life and liberty and property. We are endowed with the rights to these things, but these, it is understood, I think, that we have an equal obligation to respect those rights in others. That we could not have these rights ourselves if they weren't held by anybody. And the fact that these rights are universally held means that we have obligations corresponding to those rights.
The next two questions, I think, kind of feed off of the first one.
What?
The second question says, can American foreign policy be based in any sense upon the principles of the Declaration?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking that these obligations you're talking about kind of create that scenario. Can you comment on that?
Yes, well, certainly the principles of the Declaration condemn aggressive war. For the same reason, aggressive war means disregarding the rights of others. And on the other hand, the Declaration certainly justifies us in defending our rights. It was in defense of our rights that we formed ourselves into political communities, and those political communities exist to defend those rights from aggression from others. I mean, that's the basic moral code that's involved there.
Yeah. The third question goes on and says, what obligation, if any, does the Declaration impose on us to be custodians of freedom of foreign peoples?
And I'd say none.
Because?
Let me go back a step and say, among the principles, unspoken principles of the Declaration, is the fact that people who do not recognize the equal rights of others cannot claim the benefit of those rights. Same reason that I don't think that, say, the 1950s communists had any right to claim the freedom of speech for themselves when their purpose were the Nazis. The Weimar history of the Weimar Republic is a history of a free republic based upon principles of equality, which was destroyed by two great movements, communists and Nazis, who were destined to replace it. And both of the parties, of those parties, should have been outlawed. They were not outlawed, and so Germany first became Nazi and then later became communist, at least East Germany, even at the end of World War II. John Stuart Mill, I think, expressed the true theory of the Declaration when he said, despotism is a legitimate mode of government for barbarians, provided the end be their improvement, you see. In other words, the theory of the British Empire what the British Empire became in the 20th century, or late in the 19th century, is what the Americans said it should have been in the 18th century, which the idea of dominion status, which meant when a colony became sufficiently sophisticated or civilized to govern itself, then it would become completely self-governing within the framework of the British Empire. The loyalty to the crown was essentially nominal, because the supplies voted by the colonial legislature would be spent according to the instructions of the legislature and the local governor, who would provide, you might say, loyalty to the crown, but that loyalty did not interfere in any way with self-government. That's what Jefferson was in effect claiming in the Summary View of the Rights of British America in 1774, which the document which really resulted, among other things, in drafting the Declaration of Independence 2 years later. But the level of civilization implied in the doctrine of the Declaration is a very high level and a very sophisticated level, one which certainly the Americans themselves had not perfectly achieved. And the possibility of self-government depends upon achieving a certain level of sophistication, which I don't think can be specified in the abstract. You don't automatically have the right to self-government by being free, safe from foreign domination, if that only results in, say, the communal slaughters that we see going on all over the world. In the Balkans, in Central Africa, in India, as a matter of fact, there's still slaughters of Muslims by Hindus and Hindus by Muslims. We see that particularly in the Kashmir and the quarrel over Kashmir. The question is which religion is going to dominate. It's important, by the way, to realize that you cannot have majority government by majority rule which does not recognize the equal right to life, liberty, property, of each citizen in his own right. It means that you can't discriminate on people on their level of citizenship or their rights as citizens on the basis of their religion. Now, there had never been a government in the history of the world in which religion did not determine the basic characteristics of citizenship. The most revolutionary thing in the American Constitution of 1787, absolutely unprecedented in any European government or any Western government, and I think in any place, Africa or Asia as well, is a statement that there shall not be any religious contest qualification for office. Without that, the use of majority rule in the American Constitution would not work. You cannot have a majority of Protestants determining the religion of Catholics. You can't have a majority of Catholics determining the religion of Protestants. You can't have Christians determining the religion of Jews, or Jews or Muslims determining the religion of Christians. Unless sectarian religious differences are not kept out of the political process, then majority rule, government by majority rule, is not possible. That's a thesis which simply was not understood by the Bush White House when they thought that all they had to do was to knock Saddam Hussein out and the Iraqis would immediately form a democratic constitution. Or thinking that because they voted, that participating in an election certainly is an element of democracy, but it's not sufficient. The fact that the Shiites voted because they wanted to stick it to the Sunnis, and they were the majority. That's Justice Scalia's constitution. The minority have no rights except what the majority gives them. That's how the Iraqis went to the polls. But nobody in the Bush White House seemed to know that. I don't know what you're going to say. I wrote letters to the Wall Street Journal, which didn't get published. Oh, God, I wrote one. The minute I heard Paul Wolfowitz, who was supposed to be a sophisticated former student of Leo Strauss, which he was not, said that we're going to bring democracy to the Middle East. I wrote a letter saying that the announcement that we're going to bring democracy automatically made every Arab government in the region our enemy. The elementary lessons of political science, simply. But I don't know whether it was his Yale degree or his Harvard degree that Paul. I like to think the Harvard degree. However, I mentioned Professor Stout saying that we don't know enough the difference between right and wrong to know whether the Union or the Confederacy was right in the Civil War. And he was a Yale professor, so. I should mention that one of the ways in which Providence was kind to me was when I discovered the Lincoln-Douglas debates, I had never taken a course in American history, either in college or in graduate school. So I was immune from the opinions which I formed. I was not prejudiced in any way. What I learned about Lincoln and Douglas, I learned from reading them. And then I found out what the historian said. These guys didn't know anything about the Lincoln-Douglas debate. Yes?
To what extent did Lincoln look at the slavery faction as just a faction with too much influence and did not represent the majority in that sense?
Well, certainly the abolitionists were not, I don't think, during the Civil War itself, when all the Southerners were absent from Congress, that the abolitionists among them had anything like majority status. Certainly race prejudice, as we now think of it, was overwhelming then. And as a matter of fact, in the years that I was growing up in the 1920s, it was, I think, worst of all. In fact, I'd say there was more race prejudice in this country in the 1920s than there was in Germany before Hitler took over. I remember as a boy asking people why Jack Dempsey didn't fight any Negro opponents. And the answer, and this is the answer, that blacks can't fight. Well, in trouble was on, there were practically no white foxes of any status. The last one was for Gene Tunney. Yes, in the back.
One of the things I think the founding fathers could have never envisioned was voter apathy.
Voter what?
Voter apathy.
Apathy?
Yeah, and to what extent would that undermine the documents that they drew up? And when we speak about majority, when 40% of the people vote, would 21% constitute a majority in the pure sense of the word?
Well, I don't regard voter apathy as necessarily a bad thing. voter apathy usually means that people they either feel that the political process doesn't serve them, or they think it serves them very well. It's hard. In one case it's bad, in the other case it's good. But you find that the highest degree of voter participation in countries where everything is at stake, you see. So as long as their rights are preserved, as long as nobody is kept from the polls, now the old solid South, from the end of Reconstruction until the Civil Rights Movement, the black people were simply denied any of the rights under law. They're just as Scalia's majority ruled, and they ruled that blacks shouldn't be considered citizens, even though the 14th and 15th Amendments said that they were. Remember, the 14th and 15th Amendments say Congress shall have the power to implement these things. And Congress was generally controlled by the Southerners. So they didn't intervene in any way. The fact that blacks didn't vote in the solid South was not a sign of apathy. It was a sign that they were not permitted to vote. If somebody doesn't vote because he's too lazy or too... usually if something sticks him in the side, there's a pitchfork behind him that says, you got to do something, then they'll vote. But the important thing is that there be no obstacle, either social or political, to participating.
Why don't we take this natural break and have lunch? Would that be all right?
It's up to you. I'm just working here.
Thanks.